Let's have a time of prayer. Gracious God, the author of all things good and wonderful and beautiful, and the nature that we enjoy here at Holden, the coming together of friends and new friends, bless this time together as we approach the holy ground of your word, that we might have eyes to see and ears to hear the wonder of what you have to tell us this day. In the name of Christ, amen. This year is the year of Luke, the pericope text for preaching and liturgical churches. It's from the Gospel of Luke, are from the Gospel of Luke. So I decided to have our Bible study when I was invited to come here on the Gospel of Luke. And we're taking an approach to it which has to do with the year of Jubilee. And actually it's an economic approach to the Gospel. The first session I suggested that people read through the Gospel of Luke this week and notice all the places that have to do with money. In my Bible, I've penciled a little dollar sign next to all of those places, and it's simply amazing. You will be amazed as you read through how many dollar signs you'll have if you do that, if you write in your Bible. And it's okay to write in your Bible, and it becomes your book, right? So try that sometime this week and see how frequently poverty and wealth and money are referred to in the Gospel of Luke over and over again. That's, in general terms, the approach we're taking. There are many ways to approach Luke. One way is to look at all the healing places. One way would be to look at all the references to the Holy Spirit. One would look for all the prayer kind of thing. But we're taking this kind of angle at Luke this week. The first session was on Luke setting down an orderly account that you might know the truth of the things that you have been taught. I've done a lot of investigating, a lot of checking on all the oral material and all of the written material about the events surrounding the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And now I'm doing this very systematically so that you might know the truth. And the word truth that he uses here is, as I said, the first session is not the same word as you have in John where Jesus said, I am the word, the truth, I'm the, what is it?
Way.
The way, the truth, and the life. Or where Pilate says, what is truth? That word is a word that talks about ultimate reality. What is ultimately real? It's a philosophical, metaphysical kind of word, if you will. Well, this word is more truth as contrasted with false. You might say it's a legal term rather than a philosophical term, that you might know that this is true and not false, not just rumor, but it's factual and actual is what he's saying. And that's the way the writer of Luke prepares us for the material that follows in the Gospel and in his second book, which is the book of Acts, the fifth book in the New Testament, which was also written by the same author. So he gives us what he considers to be factual material about the life of Jesus from roughly 4 BC. Jesus was born 4 years before Christ. So we think from 4 BC to about 30 AD in the Gospel, and then from about 30 AD till about 64, 65, in the first chapter of the history of Christianity in the book of Acts, you have two generations covered by these two books. An orderly account, says the Gospel writer. Then yesterday, we were looking at the fourth chapter of Luke, Jesus' first sermon before his home congregation in Nazareth, where he quotes the scripture from Isaiah chapter 61, about the release of the captives and bringing good news to the poor, recovery of the sight of the blind to set free the oppressed, and then says, now this is being fulfilled in your hearing. I have been anointed. What does that word anointed remind you of? Well, if you know your language, biblical languages, it's the word Messiah. The Messiah is the anointed one. And it meant in ancient Hebrew lore, the crowning of the king. Instead of putting a crown on the head of the king, you took some mobile oil and poured over his head. And that was to symbolize that his mind would now be lubricated so that he would be a more effective thinker, an effective leader. And that term is picked up in the New Testament to refer to whom? To Jesus, the Christ. The word Christ in Greek is the same word as the word Messiah in Hebrew. Jesus, the Christ, Iesus ho Christos. Not that Christ was Jesus' last name. It wasn't Joseph Christ and Mary Christ and a little boy named Jesus Christ. But it's the office, like we would say, John the lawyer or Mike the carpenter. Jesus the Christ, the Messiah, the one anointed, the anointed one. So I have been anointed to give, to bring this wonderful, wonderful good news. You know that what that good news is? That's the word gospel. Euangelion. I have come to bring a gospel. The good news to the poor and the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. The Jubilee year, which as we saw on the video yesterday, Sarah Henrich and many other scholars see as Jesus calling for the Jubilee year on the basis of the Leviticus chapter 25, which you looked at yesterday in connection with Sarah's Bible study with you. And what we're suggesting this week is that we can look at the whole ministry of Jesus as announcing the Jubilee, as announcing the good news to the poor and proclaiming the acceptable year of the Lord, as the old version has it. Now that's a little bit of review. That Bible study on videotape really ought not be used as we used it yesterday in 1 hour. It's designed to be, as you probably guessed, a study for at least 2 one-hour sessions, maybe hour and a half sessions. And if you'd like to use it in your church, I've circulated a brochure where you can order it through the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church resources. And I did bring 10 copies of it with me, thinking some of you might be so eager to have it that you'd want to get it here. So if you'd like to do that, they're available. In fact, you get a bargain. $10 if you buy it from me, $12 plus handling if you order it through the ELCA. So if you want to relieve me of that so I don't have to carry him home again, I'd be glad to make them available to you, for you to use in your congregations. They're really designed to precipitate some discussion, and I gave you a portion of the study guide that comes with the film, not all of it yesterday, but a portion of it. And thought we might spend a few minutes this morning, if you'd like, to field some questions or discussion on some of the things that you heard from Sarah yesterday, or something that came off the study guide, if you'd have a chance to look at that overnight. Anybody want to say anything or ask a question about that before we go on to our topic for today? Feel free. You all understand what the year of Jubilee was all about. The 50th year was to be a special year for the Hebrew people.
When Jesus is proclaiming the year of the Jubilee, he's not talking about a year.
No.
He's talking about always.
He's talking about how the community of Jesus' people would live together. Yes. And as Sarah said in her presentation, it's really not necessarily a day or a year, but could be any time. I was interested that one writer had actually tried to figure out whether the time when Luke was writing was a 50th year in the history of the Hebrew people, and if he did indeed have a year in mind. Interesting kind of speculation, but it would be almost impossible to figure that out. And most people don't see it that way. They see it in a more general way.
I was going to say, when I was reading this and or just glancing through it, it made me think about the communes that were started in the 60s, I guess. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I know some are still in practice, but they sort of dwindled. But I think that's what they were basically set up for.
And in the 19th century, here in the United States, there were a number of communal communities. If you don't mind my using the word, communist communities. Don't let that word communist scare you off. We always think of the Soviet Union when we think of communists, but that's actually, the Soviet Union was not very good communism. It was not true to the vision of Karl Marx at all. Karl Marx understood that the classless society was going to come gradually. He believed that history was unfolding. It was a Hegelian understanding of history, if you know the philosophy behind that. And the Bolshevik Revolution did was to try to foist that kind of vision on people by violence, which is a totally different understanding of how that is to happen than was in Karl Marx's mind. There's an interesting Mexican theologian whose name is Jose Miranda, who has written some books on Karl Marx and the Bible. We think of them as opposites, but he gave some lectures at the Twin Cities a few years ago, and in the lecture he said, "Where do you think Karl Marx got his ideas? He got them from the scripture. He got them from Jesus." And then he cites this passage, and he cites the passages that Sarah referred to in the Bible study from Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4, where the people organized themselves without private property, where no one was in need. No one was in need. Why? Because nobody was allowed to pile up a whole bunch of wealth at the expense of other folks. There was an egalitarian understanding that everybody would serve each other. Was the vision that Jesus had. And the vision of the classless society that Karl Marx had was not substantially different from that. Allow yourself to think about that. Maybe that's a bit of a scary notion to some of you, but allow yourself to think about that. In Europe, during the 50s and 60s, when I was a much younger man, there were a number of dialogues between Marxists and Christians that were taking place. And believing that there was a common vision that Christians held about what society should be and what the Marxist vision was as to what society should be. Any other comments about this?
Capitalism, doesn't that assume that people are selfish and goes from there?
I think you'd have to say that capitalism is based upon human greed. And capitalism is based on the notion that that we're all greedy, so the best way to check our greed is to have greed against greed, we call it competition. And so nobody really gets to carry away the whole ball of wax, because you've always got somebody else competing with them. And I don't know, you know, I used to speculate with my people when I was a pastor, do it in sermons sometimes. Maybe the biblical vision, I'll call it that, of what society might be is just too beautiful, too wonderful, too magnificent for us to implement, us crummy old people who have all this desire to get ahead, you know, to get the other guy. Maybe it doesn't work. And maybe the only way it can work is if there is a great central power that makes it work. And of course, as Lord Acton said, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So what happens when you put that central power in there is the whole thing becomes corrupt. Huh? And kills the vision, destroys the vision. So what are we going to do with that? You know, that's something I think about a good deal, is how shall I put this, manage a society or allow a society to grow and flower that's in keeping with this marvelous understanding in a world that's full of sin. How do we do that? Yeah.
This past month, I was in Seattle and I visited a person who it was just a coincidental visit. But anyway, he and his wife were heading from Arizona to somewhere in Oregon for a grand reunion of a commune. And the commune was rather well known in the 60s, but it fell apart. And the leader felt, you know, and they said that it was Christian-based, and thousands of people had come in and out of it, and they tried it. I think it's very similar to Jesus people, but it's its own name, whatever it was, the Sun people or something. At any rate, it fell apart, because the leader became entrapped by the power and that. So, the one thing that doesn't get counted into any of these systems is the human sinful nature that it just doesn't seem to be corrected. More than one generation, at least.
So maybe what we're stuck with is efforts to approximate this vision. And and with that thought in mind, let me tell you about something that's happened now. Have you heard of Jubilee 2000? Who's heard of Jubilee 2000? What were you going to say?
That's mentioned in here. That's what I was reading. It suggested a third session on this. It's mentioned
yes.
on that.
Yes. It's in your study guide.
I'm wondering what your reaction would be. How can there be more freedom for the poor as we enter the new millennium? What can each of us, our churches, our government, do about this challenge? Mm-hmm.
I wrote that.
I'm sorry. It just caught my eye. I mean, that's my concern. The poor, we send food all over them. And I just read that book mm-hmm. where in Bosnia, food was sent in the bay to sit there. It was mm-hmm. not for sale, but they don't give it to the people, yeah. the distribution.
Jubilee 2000 is a movement that started about 2 or 3 years ago. Out of the Church of England, there was a woman who had a vision. And it was the problem that so many poor countries have in the fact that they have huge indebtedness that they've had for 30 years, back to the 70s. Most of the indebtedness came during the 1970s for a variety of reasons that I won't try to get into now. And sometimes there's been a succession of governments so that the government that made the debt is no longer around. But the government that's now in place inherits that debt. And the debt is so enormous that assuming that the government is honest, and in many countries it is, and would like to do things for its people, its education and healthcare and hunger and all the rest, but they can't do it because they have to pay millions, billions of dollars to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and commercial banks in the industrialized world and many governments of industrialized countries, including the government of the United States, which has made some of these loans to some of those countries. And what the Jubilee 2000 movement is asking for is that these debts be forgiven, or at least reduced on a case-by-case basis. Not that all the debts are forgiven, because some governments would abuse that. But on a case-by-case basis, that these countries would be allowed to be freed, Jubilee, huh, from this indebtedness, and that the year 2000 be the year of Jubilee. It's based on this whole thing we've been talking about. These are people who are Christians and Jewish people who are in this movement. Now that organization has just been, that movement has just been organized in the United States, and I put the address of that organization in front of you if you'd like to get in touch with them. 222 East Capitol Street Northeast in Washington, D.C., 20003. And then I put the website up here too, if you'd like, if you have that available to you. CORD@J2000USA.org. I've been an active member of this. I went to Washington, D.C. 3 months ago for a weekend training conference on Jubilee 2000. And there's going to be a major national Jubilee 2000 conference, a convention in Washington in October, which I hope to attend. Some of you have in front of you this Bread for the World brochure. If you turn to page 4 in that brochure, you will discover that Bread for the World, how many of you know Bread for the World? That's such a well-known organization. An interfaith, faith-based ecumenical organization that's trying to remedy the problem of hunger around the world. And you'll notice now that Bread for the World has decided to make Jubilee 2000, this movement, its major thrust for the year 1999. You know, every year, Bread for the World has what they call an offering of letters. How many of you have done that in your congregations, had offerings of letters? This year, it's on Africa to try to deal with the problem of hunger in Africa. Next year, it will be offerings of letters to urge the United States government to get behind this program, Jubilee 2000. And if you turn to page 6, you will see the face and a letter from David Beckman, who is the national president of Bread for the World. And did you know that he's a Lutheran pastor? And he's also an economist. Has his PhD in economics and used to work for the World Bank. So he knows what he's talking about. And David Beckman has been talking about Jubilee 2000 now for a couple of years.
How does the federal government feel about this so far?
There are a number of congresspeople and senators who have who've gotten behind this effort. One of them is Paul Simon, who was he's not in the Senate anymore. He's retired. He left the Senate now. Do you know Paul Simon, who's a senator from Illinois? Fine man. In fact, it was his brother who organized Bread for the World. Did you know that? Arthur Simon? They're Missouri Synod Lutheran people, the Simons. And how many of you are part of the ELCA Women's Organization? Have you gotten your current magazine? You get this when it comes? this issue is devoted entirely to poverty, to the poor around the world. And there's a Bible study on Luke 4, 16 through 30 in here. You don't even have to be here for this. You could go home and do your own study on the basis of this book. And there's also an article by Paul Simon, the former senator from Illinois, in which he says, just to quote a piece of this, interestingly, while there are no specific biblical commands to get rid of slavery, there are hundreds of commands in the Bible to alleviate poverty. How about that? And then he says, in the United States, we have by far the highest percentage of children living in poverty of any Western industrialized nation. And we sing God Bless America. Huh? Let me read that again. In the United States, we have by far the highest percentage of children living in poverty of any Western industrialized nation.
The Western hemisphere, yeah.
Europe and North America. The rich countries. Of all the rich countries, and we are the richest.
Yeah.
We have by far more children living in poverty in our country than they do in France or Germany or England or Italy or any of those countries. We ought to be ashamed of ourselves. That's absolutely scandalous in a country as wealthy as our nation is.
Why is it happening?
Answer it. Answer your question.
What would be the comparison in rates of single motherhood between our countries?
We are the highest.
No, that's one of
that too.
One of them is single mother.
It's one of the reasons. But let's not be racist about this, friends. The great majority of the children who are living in poverty in the United States are white. Mm-hmm. They're not black. They're not Hispanic. The percentage among blacks and Hispanic is higher than among whites, but the great majority of children who are living in poverty in the United States are like us, Caucasian, good old Norwegians and Swedes, and Germans and stuff. This little magazine is really, really marvelous. There are lots of statistics in here about poverty in the United States that are so alarming. If you haven't known this before, you will be absolutely amazed at the amount of poverty in this country. And it's not all in the cities. It's in the rural countryside. It's in small towns. And it's not only among colored folks. It's among white people as well. We have a dreadful problem within our own country. And then if you take it on a global scale, do you know that there are, I used to have these figures at my fingertip. There are about 40,000 children that die of malnutrition-related illnesses, preventable illnesses, every 24 hours on this planet. How big is the town you live in? 40,000. That many people, children, most of them are under age 5. Die because they are not inoculated, or they are malnourished, and that's the people, that's the kids who die. That does not count the kids who continue to live, and are blind. Many are blinded by malnutrition, protein deficiency, on a global basis. And we, in our church, the ELCA, have a hunger program that does raise an amazing amount of money. It raises several million dollars a year to deal with hunger abroad. And that's beautiful. That's absolutely magnificent. But when you think about it, folks, if we could forgive the debt of those poor nations so that they could take care of themselves, we could help many, many, many more people than we can by shipping our dollars from our offerings abroad. I'm not saying we should give up on the hunger program. Don't misunderstand me. That's a good thing. But we need not only to do that, but we need to get into political advocacy, folks. Don't be afraid of that. We need to become political as Christian people and push our governments to deal, the rich governments of the world, who fund the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, to deal with those debts on the part of poor nations.
But what do? We're in debt ourselves, and we don't even pay our due to the United Nations.
That's right, you don't. The United States has become more and more isolationistic. We've drawn in upon ourselves, and more have we isolated ourselves from the community of nations. You see that happen all the time. It's a very, very dangerous development.
That's
very arrogant on our part.
Do you have a listing of some of the nations that
let me bring that next time.
Oh, okay.
The International Monetary Fund has identified 41 countries that they call HIPC, H-I-P-C, the highest indebted poor countries, H-I-P-C, 41. Most of them are in Africa. And they do have a program in place for reducing the debt of those countries over a long period of time. The country that so far has received the benefit of that is the country of Uganda. There are two countries that are in line now for debt consideration in 1999, and there are two more that are in line for consideration in the year 2000. In order to be considered by the International Monetary Fund for debt reduction, these nations have to go through a very stringent economic reform internally. They have to, for example, they have to increase their exports. And one of the things that happens as a result of that is that countries put their energy behind producing products not for their own people, but for Americans. Yeah. Like in Honduras, for example. I've been in Honduras a couple of times. You fly over Honduras and you see miles and miles and miles and miles and miles and miles and miles of banana orchards. Well, guess who gets those bananas? We ate them for breakfast this morning. the local people don't get those bananas. They get some, of course, obviously, and they get some jobs out of that, but they pay them for a day what our workers get for an hour or less. Mm-hmm. And they're very poor. Honduras is the poorest nation in Central America, but it has these miles and miles of banana orchards that belong to American corporations, the American Fruit Corporation. It's another form of colonialism. It's been called economic colonialism. We've given political freedom to countries that used to be colonies, but now they've become economic colonies. They continue to be as dependent upon the rich countries as they ever were when they were political colonies.
Well, how do you deal with all that you're saying in comparison to what is on the board there? Blessed are you who are poor.
We haven't gotten to that yet. But we will. Well, I labor this, folks, and I maybe should apologize for all the sermonizing I'm doing. But it's something I really care about. I think it's an urgent issue, and it's a time that has come. It's an idea that is appropriate for us to think about as Christian people, it seems to me.
Will you be addressing how you feel about ownership of stock in corporations at some point?
Well, I didn't plan to. We can talk about that. We can, seriously. We can talk about that. Yeah. Not today, but thank you. Thank you, Carmen. I'm glad you raised that, because I do have a bunch of stuff with me, believe it or not. before you jarred my mind, I was going to say something else. Obviously, something really great got me. Oh, I know what it was. Are you familiar with Sojourners magazine? Any of you? How many of you know this magazine? It comes out of Washington, D.C. There's a Christian community in Washington that is called the Sojourners community, and they publish this magazine. It's really a fine magazine. And the May is published every other month. The May, June, and the July, August issue of this year, this summer, have major articles on what we're talking about now. Ched Myers, who has been here at Holden Village a number of times, wrote a book called Binding the Strong Man, a commentary on the Gospel of Mark, which I used last year in our Bible studies here, has some biblical studies on Luke and Jubilee in these two issues this year. If any of you would like to look at this, you're welcome to do that. Don't steal it, because I need this. That's what I was going to say. Well, let's move along. Blessed are the poor. Let's look in Luke at chapter 6, verse 20, 21. How many of you are familiar with the Jesus Seminar? How many know about that? What is the Jesus Seminar?
From what I understand, it's a group of very intellectual, theologically oriented people trying to study the historical Jesus and what he is saying in the scriptures. I've read some of Mark Borg's stuff, and I think he is a part of that.
Who is it?
Mark Borg.
Marcus Borg, yes, right.
University of Oregon?
Oregon State. In Corvallis, yes. Bunch of they're biblical scholars, mm-hmm. professors in seminaries all over the country, the United States, who are professors of Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, who have been meeting now for a long time and trying to determine which sayings, now not actions, not deeds, not miracles, but which sayings of Jesus really said. He really said. On the assumption that there are some sayings in the scripture that Jesus really did not say. That you may not be able to accept that assumption. That's the assumption they're making. And what they've done is they published a volume now called the Five Gospels. Do you know why it's five Gospels? Is it a four?
Four. I suppose they've come.
It's called the Five Gospels.
Can they answer the Acts?
No.
Have they written one?
No. Pardon me?
Did they include Thomas?
The Gospel of Thomas is the fifth Gospel. Yes. Which was discovered just not too long ago, about 50 years ago, late 40s, 50s. And what they've done in this volume, and this comes out of the library here if you want to look at it, is to color code the sayings of Jesus. They have a bright red, I have the page here in front of me, they have a bright red, if Jesus undoubtedly said this or something very like it. And they use a pink if Jesus probably said something like this. And they use a gray if Jesus did not say this, but the ideas contained in it are close to his ideas. And then in black, Jesus did not say this. It represents the perspective or content of a later or a different tradition. Those are the four categories. And what these scholars have done is to vote, on their understanding of that particular saying that they're talking about at a given time. And they've gone through all five Gospels now and color-coded the sayings of Jesus. There are a number of Lutheran Bible scholars who have been a part of the Jesus Seminar. Many of them took themselves out of it, out of the process after a while, because they felt that that it was it had been taken over by those who were very negative about the Bible. And I remember David Teedy, who's the president of Luther Seminary, he and I talked about that one day, and he said they've developed the notion that the Gospel of Thomas is the oldest gospel, older than the other four, and he doesn't believe that. He thinks it came later. So the date of the Gospel of Thomas is important to this consideration. Now, I don't want to get into a whole bunch of stuff about Jesus Seminar, but just to give you that background, the Jesus Seminar has decided that this passage from Luke 6, 20 and 21, they give it the second highest read coding of any passage in the Gospels, in the five Gospels. The only passage that has a higher rating is also from Luke. Luke 6, 29. It's in that same chapter. Uh, 94% of the scholars agreed that these verses, Luke 6, 20 and 21, are certainly the words of Jesus. And it's interesting, if you look at the Gospel of Thomas, if you pick up this volume, you will find that there are parallel sayings in the Gospel of Thomas, parallel to these verses we're looking at. The sayings are numbered. Number 54 says, they translate the word blessed with the word congratulations. Maybe that strikes you as a little weird, but the word for blessed is a difficult word. We can talk about that if you like. But they translate, congratulations to the poor, for to you belongs heaven's domain. Belongs the kingdom of heaven. We might translate it, if the RSV translation would be, blessed are the poor, for to you belongs the kingdom of heaven. Almost exactly what you have in Luke. And saying number 68 in the Gospel of Thomas is, I'll retranslate, blessed are you who are hated and persecuted, and no place will be found wherever you have been persecuted. You'll notice that that follows what's in Luke also. I think that's the next verse, actually, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then saying 69 is, blessed are those who have been persecuted in their hearts. They are the ones who have truly come to know the Father. That part of it is black in the code. But the second half of this saying is what we have in Luke. Blessed are those who go hungry, so the stomach of the one may be filled, is the translation. Now, if you keep your finger on that passage, turn to the fifth chapter of Matthew. This is the more familiar Beatitudes, as we say, or Sermon on the Mount. The way the Sermon on the Mount begins, yes. And sometimes this is called the Sermon on the Mount, and in Luke it's called the Sermon on the Level or the Sermon on the Plain. You'll see that Jesus, it says that Jesus was on the level. He's talking on the level. Now, let me ask you, what contrast do you see between Matthew's Beatitudes and Luke's Beatitudes? What do you see, anybody, by the way?
Poor in spirit.
Pardon me? Say it out loud, please.
Matthew says, blessed are the poor in spirit.
The poor in spirit. Matthew adds, blessed are you who are poor. And the Gospel of Thomas says, blessed are you who are poor. Matthew spiritualizes the poor.
Mm-hmm. What color is that?
I didn't look that up. I didn't look that up. I will, however. What else do you see as contrast? Anything else? Well, that's the most important one, I think. And notice that Matthew refers to the kingdom as the kingdom of heaven. That's consistent in the Gospel of Matthew.
Hunger and thirst for
Luke's
righteousness.
Luke says kingdom of God. Pardon me?
One says hungry now, the other says hunger and thirst for righteousness.
That's right, yes. Again, the hunger beatitude is spiritualized, if you will, in Matthew. Well, Luke says, blessed are you who are hungry now. And Matthew says, blessed are you who hunger and thirst for righteousness. That's a little different, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So what do we make of this? What do we make of this? The question is, who are the poor? Who are the poor that Jesus is talking about? Well, I'm going to suggest that there are four ways of looking at the poor. This is me now. This is not Luke. This is me, okay? This is Smithian stuff, for what it's worth. Four ways of looking at the word poor. One is what I will call voluntary poverty. Do you know what the oath is that a monk takes?
Poverty,
chastity, and obedience. Yes. That's voluntary poverty. I decide that I'm going to, like St. Francis of Assisi did, though he was a son of wealthy aristocratic people, he left the fortune he would have inherited, disowned it, and became a beggar. Voluntary poverty. I was reading a couple of Roman Catholic commentaries on Luke, and they talk about that. But this is what Jesus meant. That blessed are those who leave the world's riches behind, and for the sake of the gospel, become poor. So that what the consequence of that interpretation would be that this passage is for those who make that kind of choice in life, not necessarily for everybody. Well, I could say more about that, but let's get on. The second one is a simplified lifestyle. That's voluntary too, isn't it? You all know what that word means. You choose. You choose it rather than it's thrust upon you. I just got, shortly before coming up here, a book by a Harvard sociologist, a woman, Juliet Shore, who became a bestseller, called The Overspent American. And it talks about how we Americans spend our money. Oh, gee. Read this, folks. It's really something. I want to give this to one of my sons, but I don't know if I dare. He and my daughter-in-law would probably hate me forever. Because I worry about how they spend their money. Oh, gee. She talks about how the whole capitalist system is based upon consumption. And the advertising. Look what happens. She puts it here. The advertising creates a fantasy. This is the line of action here. Advertising creates a fantasy, which creates a desire, which creates a want. And the things that my parents would consider to be luxuries become necessities. Huh? We have to have a microwave. We can't live without a microwave. Refrigeration, can't live without that. My mother-in-law used to go to the cistern and get water and heat it to wash her clothes. She didn't have an old washing machine. Luxuries become necessities in rich countries. Most people in the world, they're still luxuries. Africa, Central America. Go to those countries, visit them, and see how those people live. Okay, ads create fantasy, creates desire, creates want, creates buying. Shop until you drop. The Mega Mall in the Twin Cities. Huge capitalist temple. That's what it is. Sacred place.
A trip to Holden, right?
Huh?
A trip to Holden.
A trip to Holden, maybe? Buying and then borrowing in order to buy, and then debt. Credit cards. Oh, gee. Isn't that the American life? And look what they've done in the cover of this.
I should pass this around.
They've got this wonderful farm couple. Grant Wood, yeah, I was trying to remember that. And this guy is doing a cell phone, and he's got a cigar, and he's got a golf club. And they've got a dish on their house for cable television. It's fun.
Not your best, have a computer the way it sounds.
But this is a very serious book. This woman is, as I said, a Harvard University sociologist, and she's done a lot of research that she puts in here, like sociologists do, to see how Americans spend their money. Well, a lot of people have really committed themselves to moving back, and she says this, about 25% of the people she's interviewed are trying to reduce their lifestyle. And many of you may have really worked at that. I know people who really have taken that seriously. Instead of buying your own lawnmower, maybe some neighbors share a lawnmower. You know, why not? You only mow it once a week. Pardon?
What will that accomplish?
Blessed are the poor.
Pardon?
Blessed are the poor.
Yeah, but because you and I own a lawnmower together isn't going to make much difference if we each own a lawnmower. Those lawnmowers made jobs for some of those poor people.
Oh, so. Well, she asks the question in this book, if people stop buying, what's going to happen to the economy?
Well,
you should think about that.
There'll be fewer bankruptcies.
Bankruptcy
is a plague.
Yeah.
That's not good for the economy.
You see, I wonder if there weren't those banana plantations paying low wages, maybe there'd be no wages at all.
Well, there might be people who have their own land and can grow their own crops and feed their own families.
There you go.
Instead of being dependent upon someone else. What's happened in the third world countries, just think about it, the word third world itself is demeaning. We're the first world, of course. The people in those countries, the land is gone, so what do? They move to the cities. And in cities like Tegucigalpa, Honduras, if you visit that place, the capital city of Honduras, the people who live on the outskirts of the city are the poor people, the poorest people. Not like our cities, the people who live on the outskirts of the suburbs are the wealthy people. These people don't even have plumbing. Kids playing in the streets out there, I've seen them. The sewerage is running down the street, and they're walking in that gook. Does that do anything? Does that do anything to our conscience, folks? And then we have money to spend on all kinds of stuff. All I'm saying is, who is the poor that Jesus is talking about? I believe that it's blessed to try to simplify our lifestyle. I believe that's blessed. I've got a whole bunch of stuff here, about a half hour stuff on this.
5 minutes.
Three, involuntary poverty. Now we're talking about the people who are victims of poverty. We've already said something about that. Globally, 40,000 kids die every 24 hours. We talked about the United States, all the kids that live. We're talking about children now, the helpless ones. helpless ones. They didn't design this life. I've been reading some books by Jonathan Kozol. Do you know that writer? K-O-Z-O-L. He's got a half a dozen books. This man has really made a commitment to going around the country and interviewing people who live in poverty. This book is about people who live in the South Bronx, which is just north of Manhattan. Manhattan has got to be one of the wealthiest places in the world. If you were trying to rent an apartment in Manhattan, you'd have to be a millionaire to rent an apartment in Manhattan. Not more than 2 miles north of that wealth are people living in abject poverty. I wish I had time to read some of the things that those people talked about when he was interviewing them. I tell you folks, I will never look at the city of New York in the same way after reading this book. I have always thought New York is a pretty wonderful place. A great center of culture, operas and theater. I will never look at New York the same way after reading this book. Please read some of this. Yeah. And the book that I think has become most famous is his book called Rachel and Her Children. This book is called Amazing Grace. This man is a Christian, and he's a scientist, he's a sociologist, who's coming at this, the issue of poverty in the United States, in this wealthy country of ours. Again, I've got a half hour material on that, which I can't read. Sorry to cut you off, Gene, we'll get to you. Gene is my cousin. Incidentally, this woman and I are related to each other. First cousin. Her mother, my Aunt Frieda, lives in Harlan, Iowa. Right, Jean?
Right.
Jean and I have known each other since we were kids, playing in the book. Out on the farm, out in Ralph and Frieda's farm, we used to play out there. Fourth. Is the poor in the understanding of the purity code. Now this really does require more explication. I need to get back to this next time, I think tomorrow. There are a couple of writers. One of them is Marcus Bork. Who mentioned Marcus Bork? Yeah, at Oregon State University has this wonderful little book called Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time. That's a marvelous book. It's in the bookstore here. Wonderful, wonderful book. And Ched Myers, the person that I mentioned who wrote these Bible studies and Sojourners, is another, who says that he thinks that when Jesus talks about blessed are the poor, what he's doing is pitting himself against the whole theology of the Hebrew people. That was centered in the temple. And that's how radical Jesus was, says these two writers. Because that theology was based on the notion of, read Psalm number 1 that says, if you are faithful, you will prosper. If you are unfaithful, you will be poor. And the poverty code, the purity code in Leviticus has a whole list of people who are considered outcasts. And they're not just economically poor people. No. They are people like, where are you, Ched Myers? Got notes here from him. All right, here's the poverty code, the list, going down the scale. Oh, come on. I got to give you this before we go. All right, the priests are at the top, naturally. Ordained. Naturally, they're at the top. Right, Phil?
Yeah.
Kermit? Steve? We know this. We know the priests are at the top, don't we? The next are the Levites. The next are the rest of the Israelites, the circumcised. Then the converts to Israel, Gentiles who became Jews. And then next are the slaves who have been set free. And then next are the illegitimate children of the priests. I won't ask you about that. Next are the temple slaves. Then are the illegitimate kids, generally out there in the population. And then there are the eunuchs. Remember the eunuch in Acts? Then there are the people with damaged testicles. And then there are people without a penis. How many of you are without a penis? I won't ask that question. Where are women in this list? That's the purity code. And what Myers is saying in his book, Binding the Strong Man, is Jesus sets himself against that whole notion that there are some people who are more pure than other people are. And what he's saying, what he's doing is turning that list upside down. And he's saying, blessed are those who are on the bottom of that list. Blessed are those who are in the bottom of that list. And then if you go on, he says, woe unto you who are rich. Woe unto you priests. Woe unto you who are on the top of the list. He turns the whole society of his day upside down. Now that's really something to think about. And maybe that's why Jesus got crucified finally. They couldn't stomach a guy like that. He was just too hard to get along with.
Well, the women weren't mentioned in there. So we
were at the bottom of the list.
We're blessed.
That's why we're at the bottom.
And that's what Luke does. One of the approaches to take to the Gospel of Luke is to see how Luke deals with women. Luke has been more than the other three Gospels by far. Luke has Jesus showing tenderness and kindness to women over and over again. And at the resurrection, who is it that first witnessed the resurrection?
Women.
Yep. Luke brings the women out of their oppressed state. We talk about women being oppressed in our society, but in those days, women had no rights whatsoever. The only way that a woman could possess property would be to be married. It was the man who had property. The woman couldn't do a thing. And if the woman was alone without a man, she was destitute. She had one choice, and that was to be a prostitute. And Jesus looks upon prostitutes in Luke with great love and care. He really, really turns the society upside down.
Didn't Jesus always claim there would be the rich and the poor?
Pardon me?
Didn't Jesus always proclaim there would be the rich and the poor?
The rich and the poor. He does say that there, in the story about the woman who comes and anoints his feet, and everybody says, that's a waste of oil, waste of perfume. Why don't you give it to the poor, you know? They really want to be good guys. And Jesus kind of sarcastically said, well, you know, you always got poor people around. So what's the big deal about that?
Well, I mean, if we're trying to prevent that, if we're trying to help the poor.
I don't think Jesus was saying that we should not.
No, I'm not saying that either.
But I know you're not.
And it's a mix-up.
Yeah. We certainly have always had the poor with us. That statement is accurate. Well, I left out a whole bunch of stuff that I thought I'd tell you about in support of these notions, but this gives you the basic outline of what it seems to me Jesus is talking about in the book. And these categories are not necessarily mutually exclusive. You can put them all together. I believe that it is blessed to leave the world's riches behind and to devote yourself totally to the things of God, as the monks have done, as Francis did. It certainly seems to me it is blessed to try to simplify one's lifestyle in this great country of ours. Blessed are the involuntary poor. How can we even say that to the involuntary poor? How can we say that to the 40,000 kids who are dying every day? How can we dare say that they are blessed? But Jesus has some kind of heart for those people. The Roman Catholic priest in Medina several years ago said that the church should show a disproportionate priority to the poor. And I raised with my congregation one time, what would happen at Grace University Lutheran Church if we really took that serious? If we said that we're going to give our primary attention to the poor. What would happen to the ELCA? What would happen to your town if you decided as a community, we are going to give our primary attention to the poor? And that's what the Catholic bishop said in Central America. Rather than the church catering to the rich, as if in the pattern of the past. And then blessed are the people who are on the bottom of the pyramid. I think they kind of go together. Thank you for today. We'll meet again tomorrow, if you dare.